We've had a little break from this chapter, and I'm so thankful to Josh for the past couple weeks. I'm really, really grateful. But you remember that we've been looking at this chapter for a while now, and so we're kind of taking this slow, really. And one reason is because this is something that's distinctive about a Christian way of looking at the world, actually. It's not the way that most people look at the world, if you think about it. Most people don't look at the world as having a beginning. They kind of think it's always been here. And they don't look at the world as having an ending. And they definitely don't think in terms of someone intentionally taking history somewhere. They don't think of history as linear. And so as they're thinking about the future, they're hoping probably that science is making things better. But there's no guarantee. Because really, whatever is going to happen to us is up to us as human beings. And so it could get better, or it could get worse. But they don't really know, because they don't believe there's someone outside of time in charge who has a plan for history the way that we do. And you know, we do believe there is a plan for history, not just a plan for our lives and not just a plan in theory. We're talking about an actual plan that God is working out in real time that involves what is going to happen to the entire universe. Which honestly probably would sound a little crazy to a lot of people out there if you start talking to them about what you believe, about the end of the world as we know it. They're going to start looking at you as if you are really strange. But you know, this is actually just kind of Christianity 101. So it's not wacky believing in an end of the world. It's not fringe thinking for us as Christians. It's run of the mill. If we're Christians, we think there is a beginning and an end to history that is revealed to us in the Bible. And that's why we can talk about last things and we can study it, because we have been told how the future is going to work out. And while God hasn't told us everything, he has told us a lot. In fact, there's a sense in which you could say that's what the whole Bible is about. The Bible is a story that reveals God's plan for the universe from the beginning to the end. And we'll just enjoy the noise back there. If you can't hear it, there's something going on. And the fact that God has revealed that plan in the Bible is really important to us and to how we live the Christian life. That's one reason we're taking this slow. We're looking at what Jesus says about eschatology, and we're taking it slow because we know that we're not taught to look at the world this way from the world. This is something you have to learn at church. This is a distinctively Christian way of looking at time. And it's really significant for how we live in this world right now. Obviously, it should be. Someone knowing something's going to end and knowing how it's going to end should look different than someone not knowing if there's going to be an end, not knowing how it's going to end. You know, we were just on a long plane ride, really long plane ride. But when we got on the plane, they told us how long it was going to be. So we could track our progress, which is kind of amazing, actually. But if we got bored, we knew, okay, it's really boring on this plane, but we only have so many hours left until we get off. But imagine, because that is a lot different than if you got on the plane up there and you're somewhere out over the ocean and the pilot says, you know what, something is wrong and we're going to have to turn around, but we don't really know what we're going to do, actually, and because we're in the middle of the ocean and we have no idea where to go. We don't know if we're going to be able to land or where we should land. All of a sudden, that plane ride is going to feel very different the way you think, the way you act. And when it comes to life, I know there is a plan versus I don't know if there's a plan. I know history is going somewhere versus I don't think history is going anywhere. I know God is involved in what is happening versus I don't think God's involved in what's happening. I know it's not all up in the air that there's a time this plane is going to land versus I have no idea how things are going to turn out is foundational. Like, it's basic. Eschatology, the study of end times, is super basic to the Christian life. It's super practical. It's not just something people like to debate about. What you believe about this, like in your heart of hearts, matters. But you know, we've got to think about it, because while that basic idea that there is an end, a time when everything changes, is foundational and really a pretty simple idea to understand, the details themselves can feel a little more complicated, because we agree on the big idea, but we tend to have a lot of questions about how it works out. I have a lot of questions about how it works out. And today we're going to look at Jesus' answer to one of the most fundamental ones. This passage is Jesus' answer to a very important question about the end times. Though it's not a question many of us normally ask, I don't think. But it is one the original disciples did. And it's a question they asked Jesus about a lot that has to do with Jesus and the prophecies God made about Israel in the Old Testament. And you need to know that's what this chapter is basically about, because Jesus is answering a question that the disciples asked him down in verse 7. So he is not just like randomly talking about the end times. He's responding to a question that particular people asked him, and the particular people who asked him this question are Jewish followers of Jesus. Like, at this point, they aren't members of First Baptist Nazareth. There wasn't like a First Baptist Nazareth. There's not a church spread across the world filled with Gentiles anywhere. And you know, the thing is, they're not even thinking about that possibility, actually. They're thinking about the nation that they're part of, that they consider God's people, Israel, and about these things that God had said he was going to do for his people in the future. And so when Jesus talks about the temple being destroyed, which was so surprising to them, they have questions about that and what it means. And they say, Luke tells us, verse 7, teacher, when therefore will these things happen? And what will be the sign when these things are about to take place? And Matthew, we saw, adds a question that Luke leaves out. They say, what will be the sign of your coming and the end of the age? So they want to know, when is this going to happen to the temple? And whether what happens to the temple, the way Jesus is describing it, is when all the good stuff that the Old Testament says is going to happen for Israel, that they've been waiting their entire lives for, is going to start. Which maybe, I know, doesn't like exactly sound like the most significant end times question in the world to you sitting there right now, because you're not part of the nation of Israel. We're not, which is where this can be a little bit of a challenge, because I mean, honestly, it's a challenge to get any of us thinking in terms of end times. Like, that is hard enough, because that's just not how most of you are approaching your life, or because it's not how the world teaches us to think about life. But then to go on and think about something specific, like, wait, what's going to happen to Israel, can feel even harder, since we're not Israel. We're all these Gentiles here from all over. But you know, it's an important question to think about, actually, for one thing, because you read the first part of the Bible, like two-thirds of the Bible, the part that we call the Old Testament, and you see that God made a lot of promises to Israel. Like, you read the prophets, that second half, Isaiah to Malachi, and sometimes it feels like they couldn't say it more strongly, that God is really, really committed to this plan that he has in store for Israel. So this isn't just details about this particular nation. This is about whether Jesus is really fulfilling the Old Testament. This is about God and whether he's going to do what he said. And this is about the future and whether the end is going to happen the way the Bible says it's going to happen, which makes this about us, even though we're Gentiles, because we're supposed to be banking our entire lives on what God says in this book about what he's going to do in the future. Like, that future event should shape us now. If you're going to get married, like, on a certain day in the future, that shapes the decisions you make now, right? You're like doing all this thinking and all this acting because you know you're going to get married on that day. If you're not going to get married on that day, all those decisions you make are going to be silly. Like, why are you renting that restaurant? You're not getting married. But that decision makes sense because you know it's going to happen. And so this event, this future event, should be shaping our daily decisions like that. And so when we talk about end times and how it's going to work out, eschatology, this is not just theory for us. This is supposed to change the way we live. If God's going to be faithful to his promises, like if we're here and we actually know how it's going to end, we should be really different people. And yet, we look at what happened with Jesus and what happened after Jesus in the New Testament, and we could wonder, honestly, what's going on? Like, how does what we see happening in the New Testament with Israel rejecting Jesus, the crucifixion, all these Gentiles, non-Jewish people, and what's happening here in the church connect with all that stuff we read God saying he's going to do in the old? Did, like, his plan change or something? Did he say, I'm going to do this, I really am going to do this, like, Hosea, go get married to a prostitute, you know, and then have her, if she's going to commit adultery on you, and then you, like, go keep chasing her and marry her, get her back, buy her back, and live the rest of your life with her as an illustration of how committed I am to this adulterous nation. Oh, no, I'm just joking, like, I'm actually changing my plan here. I'm going to do this instead. Like, I think there could be some real questions here. Real questions, and those kinds of questions matter, even if it doesn't feel like that to us at first. We're like, I'm not into all this technical stuff. We need to know, how does what happened with Jesus impact the promises God made to Israel about the future? And you know, throughout church history, honestly, you'll find different people answering that question a little differently. So there are different opinions out there, and they've got reasons. They've got reasons. But this passage is one of my reasons for answering it the way I do, because I think that what we get to look at here is Jesus' answer here. It's a little tricky because a lot of times with prophecy, there's a future event, a near future event, and then there's a longer term fulfillment of that event. And that's a little bit of what's happening here. Like when you see a mountain range from far off, the first mountain might seem like it's right next to that further mountain, but the closer you get to it, you realize, oh, there's a big gap between those mountains. That often happens in prophecy, and that can make understanding prophecy a little difficult, and that certainly is happening here. But I think we're getting Jesus's answer ultimately about what's going to happen at the end of the world here to the nation of Israel because of who he's talking to. He's talking to Jewish people who are asking him about the end, and I don't think that he's talking over their heads, but answering their questions. And the first thing that he tells them is that the end that they're hoping for is not going to happen for a while. So that's like number one, if we're walking through Jesus' answer. Whatever good things they're hoping to start happening to Israel are not going to be happening right away. In fact, for a long time, it was going to look like the opposite, and like God wasn't fulfilling the good promises he made to Israel through Jesus, because after Jesus died, they weren't going to see like this massive revival in the nation of Israel as a whole, like Jeremiah talks about, where everybody repents and is transformed and knows God. But spiritually, it was going to become really dangerous for them, even more dangerous, because there were going to be lots of people pretending to be the Messiah and saying things that were not true about what God was doing. And so Jesus says they need to be prepared for that. They ask, when will these things be? And Jesus is like, no, first of all, let's talk about what happens next right after I die. You're going to need to see to it that you're not deceived. Verse 8, for many will come in my name saying, I am he, and the time is at hand. Do not go after them. And when you hear of wars and disturbances, do not be terrified, for these things must take place first, but the end does not follow immediately. And maybe like underline, the end does not follow immediately. And you see, of course, that he even tells them why it doesn't. He says, these things must take place first, and must means it's necessary. So when you see Israel going the absolute wrong direction immediately after Jesus dies, it doesn't mean that God's not going to keep his promise. It's actually part of how God is keeping his promise. And yet, because God is keeping his promise this way, you know that the end you're hoping for isn't happening right away. But again, that doesn't mean it's not ever going to happen, because verse 10, Luke says, then he continued saying to them, nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be great earthquakes and in various places, famines and plagues, and there will be terrors and great signs from heaven, which is related to what they were asking him about. We've just like fast forwarded from the years right after Jesus' death to the future, because they said, what will be the sign? And Jesus says, make sure you're not deceived in the next few years, because there's going to be a lot of difficult stuff. But after all that stuff, you know there will be terrors and great signs from heaven. And I think ultimately he's talking about the fulfillment of the Old Testament promises there that the disciples were hoping for. That's maybe prefigured by the fall of Jerusalem, but ultimately it's the fulfillment of the promises the disciples were hoping for. But then verse 12, we're back to this whole idea that he's stressing, that while that's coming, it's not coming for a while, because Jesus says what? He says, before all these things. And before is a word that indicates time. Before all these signs of the end that you're asking me about, they will lay their hands on you and will persecute you, delivering you to the synagogues and prisons, bringing you before kings and governors for my name's sake. And you know the they Jesus is talking about are the disciples' parents and brothers and relatives and friends. And so that means it's Israel he's talking about, rejecting the disciples. And it's because they're rejecting Jesus all over again, which means that instead of the nation of Israel realizing that what they did to Jesus was like the worst thing they could have done, and turning back, most of them were going to actually buckle in and become even more antagonistic to Jesus, which I think you can see would lead to some questions about God and Jesus and those promises in the Old Testament, like what's going on. And so the next thing Jesus does here is say, whatever you do, don't give up. Because this is going to be hard, but it's not a time for you to shrink back. Instead, all this opposition will result, verse 13, in an opportunity for your testimony. So that's what this time is going to be about. We're going to see in Acts, you're going to be my witnesses. After 40 days of Jesus talking about the kingdom of God in Acts 1, the disciples are still like, is this the time when the kingdom is going to be restored to Israel? And Jesus is like, you're still not asking the right question about what's going to go on right now. That's not for you to know. What's for you to know is this is the time for you to be my witnesses. And so he says here in Luke 21, trust me and settle it therefore in your minds not to meditate beforehand how to answer, for I'll give you a mouth and wisdom which none of your adversaries will be able to withstand or contradict, which at first sounds like this amazing promise, and it really is, because Jesus is saying he's going to be with them and strengthen them. They're not going to be alone as they face this persecution. But then he says, you will be delivered up even by parents and brothers and relatives and friends, and some of you they will put to death. You will be hated by all for my name's sake. So like, I'm going to help you answer, and they're not going to be able to withstand you, but then they will put you to death. But you know what? You will win in the end, he says. Not a hair of your head will perish. By your endurance, you'll gain your lives. He's actually reminding them of another time when Israel was in exile in the book of Daniel, when those three young men took a stand for Christ and they were thrown into the fiery furnace. And in Daniel, it says not a hair of their head was singed. And Jesus is saying, you know, they might throw you into the furnace, but I'll be with you like I was with those three young men. And you're going to win in the end. And they're going to need that kind of encouragement from Jesus big time, because not only were they going to see Israel becoming more and more hostile to what God was doing through him after he died. In a few more years, they were going to see God judge Israel for it. Verse 21. But when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know its desolation is at hand. And hearing that must have been so shocking, because it meant that after Jesus died, Jerusalem wasn't going to be exalted. Read Isaiah 2 sometime and see what Isaiah prophesied about happening to the temple area and to Jerusalem. It's like nations streaming to it. And here, and actually describes it like as a mountain that is lifted up above all other mountains. So the temple was on a mount. This mount is going to be like supernaturally lifted up. So it's the highest mountain in the world. And that might just be a picture, but it's a picture of the temple becoming this really important place that everybody wants to get to. And Jesus says, no, it's not going to be exalted, Jerusalem. It's going to be destroyed. It's not going to be like rescued. It's going to be judged. Like, people aren't going to be wanting to come to Israel. They're going to want to get out of Israel. You're not going to be happy if you were having babies and you were Jewish and more Israelites were being born at that point in time in history, because it was going to be a terrible time to be part of the nation of Israel. For Jesus says, these are the days of vengeance, verse 23. For there will be great distress upon earth and wrath against this people. Verse 24, they will fall by edge of the sword and be led captive among the nations. And he's talking about what happened to Jerusalem in 70 AD. So that happened, and he's describing it as a judgment from God, which is what the disciples were hoping was going to happen to Israel's enemies in the end. But Jesus is saying is actually first going to happen to Israel in 70 AD after they reject him. They were going to enter into an intense time of judgment where it's like God put his work with Israel as a nation on pause. So throughout the Old Testament, he's working with Israel as a nation, clearly. And it's like he's putting his work with Israel as a nation on pause. And I think you could say that's the second thing Jesus tells them after they ask him about the end. First, he's like, it's not going to happen for a while, but stay strong, because all this persecution, all this difficult things you're going through, all these difficult things you're going through, it's not a surprise. It has to take place. And then there's going to be a judgment on Jerusalem, which kind of reorders the focus right now. He says in verse 23, there will be wrath against these people, and they will fall by the edge of the sword, and they will be led by the captive into all the nations, and Jerusalem will be trampled underfoot by the Gentiles. And what's it say next? If you look down at it, it might help some of you. Look down at it. It says, until. And that's a word that indicates we're talking about a time period now. Like, this judgment kicks off a time period that's going to last until. And that's the time period we're living in right now, which he calls the times of the Gentiles. And times of the Gentiles is a phrase almost like day of the Lord. It's like a time period where a lot of the focus is on Gentiles, which is what we see happening by the end of the book of Acts. And is the thing we're wondering about, if Jesus is the Messiah, and we read the Old Testament, and we're expecting him to be fulfilling all these promises to the nation of Israel. And Jesus tells the disciples, you need to understand, that's not exactly the time we're living in right now. Because after Israel rejects Jesus, they reject the disciples, and then Jerusalem will be judged. And it's like the way God was working with Israel as a nation is put on pause, and we enter into a time period we can call the times of the Gentiles. And this time period, this reordering where the focus seems to change, is not completely random or like some last minute fix that God is putting into play when he sees things aren't working out quite the way we might have expected, but is serving a purpose, which I think you could say is the next part of Jesus' explanation. And it's important to stress, because while Israel was totally responsible for their rejection of Jesus and judgment, God still had a purpose for doing what he did that was connected to the plan he set in motion in the Old Testament. Even in Acts, when Peter preaches about the crucifixion of Jesus, you remember how he's like, he was put to death by the hands of wicked men according to the predetermined plan of God. And the first part of this great purpose that God is working out through this wicked rejection of Jesus, he says, is to punish the nation of Israel for refusing to submit to the Messiah, verse 22. Because these are the days of vengeance. And that word vengeance is defined as penal retribution. And so it's a punishment for guilt. If you remember the Old Testament, God entered into a particular kind of relationship with Israel. And he gave them a covenant. And he makes promises to them. And he gives them certain responsibilities. And they fail those responsibilities. And he warns them there will be consequences. Like from the beginning, he told them. In Leviticus, he says, if you walk in hostility against me, then I will walk in hostility against you and bring upon you a sword which will execute vengeance for the covenant. And that particular generation was so hostile to God that they crucified the Messiah that he sent. And so God did what he said, and they fell. How does Jesus put it in verse 24? They fell how? By the edge of the sword. Like, that's totally Leviticus. And that judgment had consequences for the nation of Israel as a nation afterwards, which Jesus had been warning them about, actually. But what's amazing is that even their rejection, which was so wicked and so wrong, was in God's hand. And it didn't throw God's plan off course. And you can see how Jesus is stressing that. Even in verse 22, what does he say? He says, these are the days of vengeance. Why? What does it say there? So that all the things which are written will be fulfilled. And he may be talking about these passages in Deuteronomy, in Leviticus. Some scholars think that he's actually talking about this passage in Daniel 9, which is a really fun one to study, but you can do it on your own. I don't want to lose you too much, but like, read Daniel 9. It's there. But whichever passage exactly he's talking about, he's making clear that while what's happening to Israel is terrible, wasn't a surprise to God or Jesus, and we're going to see was actually going to be used to advance the plan that was laid out in the Old Testament. And we'll talk about how in a minute. But look, right now, just know that, like, if God can use people that hate Jesus so much that they crucify him to fulfill his promises for how he's going to save the world, if even that doesn't stop him, then we should be really certain about everything he says he's going to do, no matter how things look to us. Like, of course, we may not be able to understand what is going on in this world right now. And we're like, how is this guy? What is that? And it can tempt us to be like, is God's plan still on? But look, there's nothing much more confusing than Israel, this nation that God's worked with for like thousands of years to prepare for this moment, crucifying Jesus when it happens, and most of them at that time period even refusing to repent after he was resurrected. And yet, however you think things exactly are going to work out with the nation of Israel in the future, Jesus is saying for sure here that what happened with Israel wasn't an accident. Even though it seemed like the worst thing ever, it wasn't like God had this great idea to provide salvation, but man, these people stopped it. Instead, he was able to use them rejecting and crucifying perfect Jesus to make another big step forward in fixing everything that's wrong with the world. And so you can trust him. He's got a plan. History is going somewhere, and nothing's going to stop him. Like, we're part of something big. Your life may be small. My life may be small. It feels like just a moment. What does it matter? All this stuff that goes on in my life. We are part of something big. There's a day coming when God's going to keep every single promise that he made in the scripture. And our lives should be transformed by that. Nothing's going to stop him. If you look here, though, Jesus doesn't really focus so much on the positive result, like I'm talking about, of Israel's rejection of Jesus as much as he does on the judgment they were going to experience. But Matthew, who records this same sermon that Jesus is preaching, gives us more of what Jesus said, like the expanded version of the sermon. And he tells us in Matthew 24, verse 14, that after Jesus told his disciples about this really difficult time that was coming, he said, "And the gospel of the kingdom shall be proclaimed in the whole world as a witness to all the nations, and then the end will come." Which I think is the time we're living in right now, because we're not quite at the end of the story yet, because what happened after Jesus was not the fulfillment of all the promises about the end times that were given to the nation of Israel, clearly, like the disciples expected. But that doesn't mean they weren't the fulfillment of something. They were the fulfillment of some other really important promises that had to happen first. Because, you know, if you go back to the beginning of the Bible, there was a reason God chose Israel. Sometimes when you're reading the Bible and all that stuff about Israel, you're like, man, this is a lot about this nation of Israel. But does the Bible begin with Israel? No, the Bible, Genesis 1 to 11, begins with everybody. Adam and Eve, they weren't Israelites. They were humans. They were just humans. And it begins that way for a reason. It's to help us understand why God chose Israel. The whole world's like in exile from God by the end of Genesis 1:11. So God rescues this nation out of exile in the book of Exodus so that they can know him for the sake of the world. He chose the nation of Israel, and it wasn't just to give them a kingdom. He chose them for the sake of the nations. And so you look at their purpose from the beginning, and the nation of Israel is supposed to be a witness. But after all this time of training and all these laws God gave them, by the time Jesus comes, clearly they're not able to be a witness to the nations because they reject the Messiah, and so they're judged. But God keeps moving his plan forward as Jesus identifies these 12 apostles to almost stand in Israel's place and do what they're supposed to do. And take the gospel of the kingdom out, which is why, you know, the beginning of Acts, there's just 11 of them, and Jesus is like, no, go back to Jerusalem, which must have sounded so crazy and scary, like you just were crucified there. But he's like, no, the plan's still on. Go back to Jerusalem, and they have to choose a 12th apostle. Why? Because God's plan for those apostles to do that work is still on, and we'll get into that when we get into the book of Acts. But I think that is part of what Jesus is talking about here in Luke when he talks about the times of the Gentiles. Because that phrase is pretty negative in this context, since he's talking about what the Gentiles are going to do to Jerusalem. He's probably thinking about Gentile domination over Israel. But we look at where Luke goes in the book of Acts, and I think this phrase is also pointing to something super positive about how God uses this judgment on Israel as an opportunity for taking the gospel out to Gentiles and bring them in. Which, if you're tracking with Luke still, you've like been reading Luke all this time over all these years, you're like, oh, of course, that makes everything make sense, because that's what Jesus has been going around saying is going to happen. Like he's telling the Pharisees, guys, you're rejecting me. It's awful. It's terrible. But that's not going to stop God from establishing his kingdom. That's only going to keep you out of the kingdom. And God's going to bring all these people into the kingdom that you think are totally unworthy and you don't expect. Which, of course, is like this big, amazing privilege for us. And Paul, you know, you read Ephesians 2, and Paul's like, guys, do you realize what a big privilege? You were without God. You didn't even have the covenants. You had no hope in this world, but God's brought you near. Even though we don't see ourselves there in the Old Testament, and we don't have any reason in ourselves why God should want anything to do with us, he does. And he's taken action, and he's provided a way for us to be part of the great big promise we read about in the Old Testament, where he's going to reverse the curse and fix everything that's wrong with the world. And that's part of why we're so in awe of what God's doing through Jesus. Because we look at Jesus and we see what? We see what? Our God is so wise. This is a kind of God who can make a way to show his justice and the evil of sin through this particular judgment on the nation of Israel, while using that same judgment and that same moment and that same event to show his grace to us as Gentiles at the same time. And yet, as great as that is, Jesus says here, that even is not the end to what God's doing. If you look at verse 24, Jerusalem will be trampled underfoot, literally, I think, in 70 AD. which kicks off this time period of judgment, until, which I'm saying is like the key word, because Jesus is not just telling the disciples about the judgment, but that there's an expiration date to that judgment. And so while the end they were hoping for is not happening yet, and they've got a work to do right now, that's an important part of God's plan, at some point, the end they were hoping for is going to happen. Because until is a word that's used to describe a time when a particular situation or condition ends. You say, I'm going to do this until. And what comes after until? A change. And so at some point, the times of the Gentiles are going to be fulfilled. And here he probably primarily means the time of Israel being cast aside and dominated and basically in exile is going to end. But I think actually, if you go over to Romans 11, Paul's talking about this same idea of Israel rejecting Jesus and being judged. And man, someday we'll preach through Romans 9 through 11, but Paul's wrestling through this whole thing that's going on with Israel, because he is Israel. He loves the Jews, and yet he's like the apostle to the Gentiles, and he's working through how does this fit into God's plan the way Luke is helping us see Jesus does here. And he gives us just a little bit of a different angle on it, Paul, because you know what he says in Romans 11:11, talking about Israel, he says, so I asked, did they stumble in order that they might fall? Like, did their rejection of Jesus mean the end? And he says, by no means. Rather, through their trespass, salvation has come to the Gentiles. So, like we're saying, the result of their rejection was not just judgment, but salvation for Gentiles who trust in Jesus. And yet, next question, like if we're wondering, does that mean it's over for Israel? Paul says, no, there's more to come. Verse 25, Romans 11:25. I want you to understand this mystery. Mystery in the Bible is like something we know now that previously was a little hidden. So when we hear mystery, we think like, oh, I know, I can't see it. It's kind of the opposite in the Bible. It's like, oh, I do know it now, but before we didn't really know it as well. So I want you to understand this mystery, brothers. A partial hardening has come upon Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles comes in, and in this way all Israel will be saved. And then if we go back to Luke, we see that Jesus says, after this period of time where God's doing this huge work in the Gentiles and Israel is judged and the gospel goes out and lots of Gentiles are saved and God fulfills the plan he's laid out, then what? Verse 25. There will be signs in sun and moon and stars and on the earth, anguish among nations and perplexity at the roaring of the seas and the waves, men fainting from fear and the expectation of things coming upon the world, for the powers of the heavens will be shaken. And you know, it's like he's finally answering the disciples' question way back in verse 7. And you look at his answer, and so much of what he's saying is Old Testament. Like, he's just alluding to, quoting the Old Testament, which I think is like super significant. Because, I mean, they're like, hey, Jesus, does what's happening right now mean that God's doing what he said he would do for Israel? And Jesus is like, no, wait, hold on. It's not going to look like it's happening for a while. There's something God needs to accomplish that's really important first. But when that's accomplished, you know what? You know what? And then he starts, like, saying all this stuff from the Old Testament about when God starts doing that. And you look at what he's quoting, and it's all associated in the Old Testament with what's going to happen on the day of the Lord, when God appears. So this is like from Isaiah. This is like from Daniel, Jeremiah, these sayings about signs in the moon and the sun and the stars, talking about this day of the Lord, when God appears in awesome power, kind of like he did in the past in Exodus, to judge sinners and to remove every threat to his people and to establish a new age of peace and prosperity. And it's all going to climax in verse 27, Luke 11, 27, when they see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory, which is talking about this time in the future from Daniel chapter 7, where Jesus is given a glory and kingdom that all peoples, nations, and men of every tongue might serve him. And, you know, I think that Jesus is reminding them of all these passages from the Old Testament to assure them, guys, it's going to get bumpy, but God is going to do what he said he was going to do. And that what they need to do is trust him. Which is actually why he talks about all this as being signs. Did you ever think about that? He says, there will be signs. Because that's not just a New Testament word either. That's an Old Testament word, signs. And where do you find the word signs in the Old Testament? A lot of different places. But where's the first place you find the word signs? It's one that the disciples would have been really familiar with, because it's a word that's used a lot when God rescued Israel from exile the first time back in the book of Exodus. And maybe you remember the very first time in Exodus that it comes up, signs. Does anybody remember? This isn't a test, but God's, the first time it comes up in Exodus is when God's talking to Moses and calling him to go back to Egypt. And Moses doesn't want to go, and he's making all these excuses. And God's like, you need to trust me and obey. And he says, I'm going to be with you, and this is going to be the sign to you that it's I who sent you. And you know what the sign is there? Do you remember what the sign is? Because it's a funny one. I think it's a funny one. He says, God says, when you've brought the people out of Egypt, you shall serve God at this mountain. And I've always thought that's a funny sign, because when does Moses get it? It's not before he goes to Egypt, but after. Like after it's all done. And so what's the sign doing then? Because I tend to think of a sign as something I get before I do something. That's like, oh, okay, this is how I know it's going to work out. But here, it's not something that Moses gets before he trusts God and acts so that he can be sure about what's going to happen in the future. He gets the word from God before he gets the sign. But he gets the sign after he believes the word from God, and God has acted to do what he said he would do, to help Moses understand the significance of what God did in that moment. Which I think is why God gives these signs here as well. Because God doesn't just want to act to save his people. He wants his people to know and understand and enjoy the significance of what he's doing while he's doing it. And what it means about who he is. He doesn't give us all this information about the end time so we can figure out, okay, like it's going to happen on July 26, like 2800. But instead, because it's going to happen, God is going to keep his promises, and he wants us to anticipate it and enjoy what it means when it happens. Which is why Jesus commands the disciples in verse 28, but when these things begin to take place, straighten up and lift up your heads, because your redemption is drawing near. Like, while the rest of the world is going to be seeing, like, this revolutionary like change in the universe that's so significant that something's happening to the sun and the moon and the stars up there, and they're fainting from fear, you should be getting excited and be responding completely differently, because you know God is acting in that moment to do everything he promised and change the world as we know it and redeem his people. And that word redemption isn't talking about the cross here. That's the way we usually talk about it. But it's talking about God keeping his promises to Israel that he made in the Old Testament and haven't been completely fulfilled yet. And, you know, that's kind of a big thing I just said. It would need a lot more proof, really. But whether or not you agree that with what I think Jesus is saying about how God's plan for the end times is going to work out exactly, because there really are some different ideas about the way he's going to keep his promises in the Old Testament to the nation of Israel that people work at explaining. Though I really do think the more you look at the Olivet Discourse and Romans 9 to 11, the more it seems like he still has a plan for the nation of Israel. But what is even more important than your interpretation of how it works out exactly is that you know it's going to work out exactly how God said it would because of Jesus. Like I want you to know the world is not going to go on and on and on and on and on as it is right now. Like with just stuff happening, other stuff happening, other stuff happening. There is an end. Do we believe that? Like there's a moment in the future when everything changes. And it's because God's in control and he's taking history somewhere. He's writing a story with history and he's written that story and he's going to accomplish it just the way he said he would. And Jesus is going to come back. And when he does, he's going to bring justice for his people. He's going to do everything God said he would do. There's no question about that. But the question is, when he comes back, is he going to find anybody out there still believing that God is going to keep his promises? Will he find faith on earth? Jesus asked that. And that means we need to ask ourselves, I think, if you really believed what Jesus says about the end of the world, would your life be any different? Because it seems like it should, right? Like, it seems like it should. I mean, if you think there's no plan or you think there is a plan, if you think the world is going on forever or you think there's an end to this world that we're living in and the beginning of a new one, where you're either going to spend forever being judged or being part of Jesus' eternal kingdom, it seems like that should impact your attitude and your priorities. And you don't have to make up how it should, because the New Testament literally tells you. Peter says, fix your hope completely on the grace to be brought to you at the revelation of Jesus Christ. Since all these things are to be destroyed in this way, what sort of people ought you to be in holy conduct and godliness? Since you're looking for these things, be diligent to be found by him in peace, spotless and blameless, and consider the patience of our Lord as salvation. I look at my life, my own life, and I believe God's going to keep his promises. Like, I want to take my stand on that. I know it's going to seem crazy to, like, most people, but I believe it. But I don't know. I think sometimes I live like he isn't. I think sometimes there's space in my life where I live like he isn't actually going to keep his promises. Maybe because I'm picking up the accent of the world in which I live. And maybe you do too. Maybe you do too. So let's pray that God helps us think and live like people who know the future. Because we don't know everything, but we do know a lot.